Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 138. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we are doing a couple of movies that were chosen by one of my Patreon patrons. Miss Jane has decided to support the podcast financially, and as a result of that, she gets to pick the two movies. Now, the movies this time around, and I found them really interesting because I hadn't seen one of them before, is the 1933 movie Dinner at Eight, starring Wallace Beery, John Barrymore, Lionel Barrymore, and Gene Harlow. And the other one is a favourite of a lot of people I know, from 1959, and it is Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, starring Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, and Marilyn Monroe. Two very different movies, but they're both in black and white, and they both are kind of transgressive in their own ways, which kind of makes them interesting for me. And I'm also going to talk about someone I'm dedicating the podcast to, an unknown and forgotten French polymath, Boris Vian, who has a special place in movie history, and I'll explain that when I talk about Boris in between talking about the two films. So sit back, relax, get yourself a drink, and we'll start talking movies.
They say the world doesn't have heroes anymore. Well, damn them, Max. You and me, we're going to give them back their heroes. Hi, this is Fifi McAfee from Mad Max, and you are listening to Paleo Cinema. Enjoy.
Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hi, how is everybody? We're doing pretty fine here. Last night I did go out for a friend's 50th birthday to a cellar bar in the city, which is decorated kind of like a Chinese brothel in a 1960s Italian spy movie. It's got all the lanterns on the roof and all of the wall dividers and great big fans and all sorts of things like that. So I had a great time there. And the cocktails are really interesting too. They've got cocktails with names like Chinese Burn and Dragon's Breath, which are pretty spectacular, but I had a good night anyway. The weather here today is pretty horrible. It's windy, it's wet, it's cold by our measurements here, and it's a good day to be sitting indoors and podcasting, which is, well, indeed what I'm going to do. As I mentioned last time around, I've got the Patreon campaign to help pay for the costs of the podcast, and I've got 8 people who have become supporters. Some are doing one-off amounts, some are doing ongoing $1 or $2 per month subscriptions, and I do appreciate that. The link to that is Patreon, patreon.com/paleocinema, one word lowercase, and you do get rewards for being a supporter of the podcast. At the $1 level, you get to have an official movie title, like in movie credits, which will be mentioned at the end of the podcast each time. And if you do $2, you get to pick the movie that I do for one of the podcasts. And at the $5 level, you get to come on the podcast if you want to and do the movie with me. Now, I do have a couple of movies this time around that were selected by Miss Jane, one of our supporters here, and she suggested, he said very carefully with too many sibilants, that we do Some Like It Hot and Dinner at Eight. I keep saying Dinner for Eight, but it's Dinner at Eight. And I agreed to that, and I thought I'd get the debt paid off as quickly as I could by putting it through this time around. Now, one of the nice things about the Patreon campaign, apart from the fact that it does help me pay the cost of the podcast, is that I get taken outside of my comfort zone a little bit as far as the movies are concerned. I do movies that I wouldn't normally do, and I enjoy that. I don't have to think up the movie, but I can do the research for it. I can talk about it. I can say what I liked, I didn't like about it, and all that sort of thing. And it is kind of nice to have that. And I found these two movies an enjoyable experience for that reason. They weren't of my choice, so it wasn't just the inside of my head I was taking into account. I was taking into account somebody else's taste and somebody else's opinion. And that was kind of cool too, even though paleo cinema tends to be the solo gig that we all know it to be. So I'm going to do the movies as usual in chronological order. So it's going to be Dinner at 8 first, and then we're going to go on to talk about Some Like It Hot and the influences on Billy Wilder that caused him to do this movie as well, because I'm going to dip into the youth of Billy Wilder in the 1920s when he moved to Berlin at the age of 20 and discuss how that's influenced his approach to movies like Some Like It Hot. So, what have I been watching? That's always the next thing on the agenda around here. I've got a new Chromecast. I'm not sure whether I mentioned it last week, but I've got a Chromecast that lets me stream internet stuff directly to my television. And yes, I'm not an early adopter when it comes to this kind of technology, but I did get there finally. And the Chromecast does some really good stuff. And I've been enjoying playing things off YouTube a lot. There are movies on YouTube, full films, and there are old TV series that I can't get otherwise unless I pay out a lot of money. So I've been watching a TV series from the late 1960s. It ran from about 1968 to 1971, called The Name of the Game. And it's basically about a bunch of crusading journalists who go and have adventures and things. And it had a rotating leading man. Each episode, they rotated between three actors at first, and then there were a few other guest stars, including people like Darren McGavin. But the three leading guest stars in The Name of the Game, well, the three leading actors were Gene Barry, Anthony Franciosa, and Robert Stack. Now, Robert Stack I can take or leave because I find him very stiff as an actor and not very good as an actor. But I do like Anthony Franciosa and Gene Barry, and there are some great little kind of 1 hour and 10 minute stories that come up on this, and it's all available on YouTube, and I can stream it up on the TV. Of course, it's in old-fashioned TV ratio, and the quality isn't quite DVD quality, but it's still not too bad at all. But the interesting thing is watching all the guest stars you get. I've seen people like Ida Lupino in episodes of this. There were people like Yaphet Kotto in it. Max Julian, who was in The Mac, was in an episode as well. Just all these character actors turn up. James Whitmore's in one of them. It's just a wealth of riches for people who follow character actors. Ed Asner is in one playing a criminal. He gets one good scene, which is a really good scene. And it's great fun watching it too. And also, one of the things is they hit a lot of social issues in The Name of the Game. And I do like that. I like the fact that they work within the censorship constraints of episodic serial television on the networks in America, at least trying to talk in a rational and fair-minded sense about a lot of social issues. And that kind of is cool. There are still a lot of episodes I haven't seen of it, but the ones I have seen, I've pretty much enjoyed. There's even a weird episode about modern-day witches with William Shatner, David Carradine, and Jose Ferrer all in the same episode together, which is kind of cool. The interesting thing, of course, being that Jose Ferrer and David Carradine totally blow Shatner off the screen. He really is cashing a check on that one, where he could have made much more of the role. But it's a very spooky and at times surrealistic episode. Starred Gene Barry in that particular case. But I've been enjoying that a lot, and I'll probably go back to watching some more movies. The only other thing I've really watched is I did Enter the Dragon for the radio gig with Liz Travaskis, and she didn't like it as much as I did, which is kind of funny, and we always kind of come to a bit of a stop and then pick up when she says, no, I didn't like it. I don't like movies where guys punch each other. I didn't know this up front, but we did talk about a lot of things and had a bit of fun with it. We're doing The Adventures of Barry McKenzie next time, which is going to be even more interesting and a bit of a push-button thing, but we will get there. We'll definitely find things to talk about and things to watch, and it's still a lot of fun to do that gig. So, on with the movies. I'm going to take a little bit of a break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about this really great thing, which isn't quite a drama and it isn't quite a comedy. It's neither fish nor fowl, but it is the George Cukor directed 1933 comedy/drama Dinner at 8, starring John and Lionel Barrymore, Jean Harlow, and Wallace Beery.
I was very fond of you, Oliver.
I was very much in love with you, Carlotta. You were the most entrancing creature in the world.
Oh, I've got eight people isn't it enough? Who could I get? And you come to me with your idiotic little, I'm the one who ought to be in bed.
Oh, darling, it's so awful not to be with you every minute.
All right. If you think I've been lying to you all the time, you're going to get the truth now.
It's the first chance I ever got with decent society people to see my name in the paper with somebody that ain't mixed in your dirty politics. And if I miss it, you're going to pay for it with everything you got.
I want to sit next to Oliver. Oliver, where's Oliver?
Okay, Dinner at Eight is a 1933 film made by MGM. It was based on a play by George S. Kaufman and Edna Ferber, and the screenplay was adapted by Frances Marion and Herman J. Mankiewicz, who we know from having worked very closely with Orson Welles on the script for Citizen Kane. So the stars of the movie are Marie Dressler, John Barrymore, Wallace Beery, Jean Harlow, Lionel Barrymore, Lee Tracy, Edmund Lowe, and Billy Burke. So basically, the story is fairly simple at the surface. There are a lot of current undercurrents and plot lines, and I'll give you the one from IMDb. Affluent Millicent and Oliver Jordan, played by Billy Burke and Lionel Barrymore, throw a dinner for a handful of wealthy and or well-born acquaintances, each of whom has much to reveal. So there are all these characters that get together. About a year before, this grand hotel, which had the two Barrymores in it, like this film as well, was made. And it's pretty much the same thing. You get a whole bunch of people coming together, in this case wealthy people, at times of their lives when they're in crisis. And things get resolved, things happen, things both positive and negative happen to various people. And it's all driven... That's the plot, basically. Now, this film was based on a play, and early sound films, a lot of them, particularly the ones that were kind of dramas and even comedies, were based on plays. Now, I was thinking this through, and cinema was only 38 years old when this movie was made. If you go back as far as 1895, when the Lumiere brothers and George Méliès and those guys were playing around with camera tricks, the genre was only 38 years old. And you've got to remember, you had World War One in the middle of that too for about 5 years. So we'll split the difference and call it 33 years old as a medium. So imagine this. Imagine that movies were only first made very primitively in 1980. We're as far away from 1980 as this movie was from the start of cinema. So we've got to realise that they were doing things with cinema based a lot on plays rather than based on ways of telling stories that are cinematic, because this is a time when we started evolving that grammar of cinema. So this one's very much a kind of film stage play in a lot of ways. But it's not bad in spite of that. The cast is fantastic. We have Marie Dressler, really interesting actress. She won an Academy Award in 1930. But a couple of years before that, she was so broke and so out of the business and so unable to get a job because she was a lady in her early 60s. Her career had been kind of broad comedies and a lot of vaudeville and a lot of stage work. And her career was kind of on the slide. She was looking for jobs as housekeepers for rich people on Long Island in the late 1920s before she had a career resurgence. And a couple of years later, she won a Best Actress Oscar. So Marie Dressler, great big lady, very over the top, very, very adept at comedy and making an entrance. And her Carlotta Vance in this film is great, a lot of fun. She's got... she's cynical and arch and bitchy and wise at the same time. She has a great scene near the start of the film with Lionel Barrymore's character Oliver when they talk about their past liaisons when he was 21 and she was in her 30s, and they're both very much older at this stage, and they kind of talk nostalgically about the fact that he proposed marriage to her And the way she reacts to that is fantastic. Now, Cukor, the director, George Cukor, said that he didn't really believe Marie Dressler playing the role of a fading beauty, or faded beauty, because she wasn't attractive in the traditional sense in any way. But she puts it across beautifully, and her little kind of self-mocking and self-knowing bits of dialogue are fantastic. She really is a treasure in this film, and there's a real sense of wisdom about her, as well as the kind of self-mocking and self-depreciating humour. At the end scene where she talks to one of the much younger players in the film, after that person has a personal tragedy, and gives her some incredibly good advice, and shows that her perspective and her failed affairs and her kind of wanton life has at least given her some wisdom that she can pass on to other people, and that's a really nice thing.
Millicent! Ducky! I never was so glad to see anyone in all my life, my dear!
Dear Carlotta.
Oh, you don't mind me rushing in on you like this, do you? I just popped in to see Oliver.
Oh, really? How nice. I'm afraid...
No, I'll wait. Anything to get out of those streets. Oh, may I have a whiskey and soda? You don't mind, do you? Millicent, really, I'm just dying.
Oh, why, of course.
Oh, my. I'm absolutely cracked up. Yeah, simply depleted. I've been in every office building from the Battery to the Bronx. Say, Millicent, you don't mind if I take my shoes off, do you?
Oh, what a relief.
Oh, me, oh, my.
No, please do.
Thank you, it's that big toes. What a city. I left the hotel at 11 this morning. A young and lovely girl. Now look at me. I took on 10 years trying to get from the Versailles to Times Square. And then I had a restful, nice luncheon with four lawyers. On the 88th floor of the Watts's building. You know, the Sky Club. A cloud floated right into my soup plate.
Yes, it's terrible, but we get used to it.
Oh, dear. The minute I see Oliver, I'm going to go back to my hotel and pop myself into bed, and I'm not going to get up until tomorrow at noon. Thank goodness I don't have to go to one of those dreadful dinners tonight.
But you're dining here.
Oh? Oh! Oh, how enchanting. Of course. The Fern Cliffs. Oh, well, that means a nice little cozy game of bridge. I can always keep awake for that.
But we are going to the theater.
Oh, oh, now, won't that be delightful? Yes, I always like to see a new play. What are we going to see?
We're going to see Say It With Music.
Oh, oh, yeah, that'll be enchanting, yes. Yes, I thought it was so amusing.
You've seen it?
Yes, yes, two or three times. But that's nothing. Oh, no, I'm used to that. Funny man. With a cigar.
Shall I mix it for you, madame?
Oh, thank you very much, my dear. Yes, that'd be very nice of you. Dear, let me see. Now, that's enough. That's enough. How complicated life is. Well... If ever... Oh, my dear, wait a minute. I'm spoiled.
Now, the film's also got John Barrymore playing Larry Renault, a kind of actor on the skids. He's an alcoholic, which indeed Barrymore was himself. He's had a number of failed relationships, and he's having a liaison with the Jordan's 19-year-old daughter, played by Madge, and he turns the page over to look at it, Madge Evans. And there's a really good scene between him and her where he tells her a little bit about his past and about the romantic tragedies he has and the fact that she shouldn't be with him. And she's desperately in love because it's her first love and she's in love with a much older man. And her fiancé is about to come back from Europe. So there's all of those kind of currents going on there. And Barrymore plays it really well. It kind of paralleled his life in a lot of ways because both Renault and Barrymore, of course, were alcoholics. And at the time, Barrymore's marriage was disintegrating as well. But he has a fantastic bit of acting as Larry Renault, who's living in a posh hotel but really doesn't know that his career has ended. And there are a number of scenes, mostly between himself and Max Caine, his manager, played by Lee Tracy, who gets a kind of thankless role of being a reality check for Larry in this film. But it's a good, solid role. And then, of course, there's a very small role by somebody whose name you hear at every single Oscar ceremony from about the 1950s on, and that is Gene Hirschfeld, there's always a Gene Hirschfeld Award for humanitarian endeavors by Hollywood people. And that was named after Gene Hirschfeld because he was a very generous man. He has a small role as a stage producer who meets Larry Renault, and Renault basically blows up in his face and totally ruins his last chance at redemption for his career as an actor. And Hirschfeld in this is kind of understated, but Barrymore's bombastic tempest smashes against him like a wave smashing against a rock. But Hirschfeld does a really nice little job in there of just kind of underplaying it and playing it very professionally, and realizing that this man isn't what he wants. It's a nice little subtle bit of acting. Then, of course, you've got the Packards in the film, played by Wallace Beery, great big beefy actor who I like a lot. The more I see Wallace Beery, the more I like him. I think that even though he does play kind of working class, over-the-top characters, I think there's a real art to what he does. And his wife is played by Jean Harlow, whom everybody remembers, mostly because she died early, but because she played Sassy Blondes. And in this one, her and Wallace Beery have a terrific chemistry. They really are suited to each other. Their dialogue, I think, is a little bit muted because they can't swear at each other, but they want to swear at each other, and you can tell that they do. And they're angry with each other, and they're sticking together for reasons that aren't really clear in some ways, but they are, even though she is having an affair with her doctor, played by Edmund Lowe. And her Dan, the husband, played by Wallace Beery, knows that something is up but doesn't really know who and doesn't suspect the doctor. But and there's also a tiny little bit part which I really like with Kitty Packard and her maid, where the maid is quite of subtly blackmailing her, which is quite an interesting and tense moment. But there is no payoff on the moment, except for the fact that she suddenly realizes that the games she's playing are very dangerous and a threat to her continued prosperity, in a sense. Now, this is the nice thing about the film being a pre-code film. Adultery, there's at least three or four cases of adultery in this film, and one of which is very interestingly handled in a very, very modern way. One of the characters is a doctor who is having an affair with Jean Harlow's character, Kitty. And there's a great scene between him and his wife, which is really handled in a sophisticated and modern way, and not with the automatic knee-jerk guilt giving that we see with a lot of these things being handled in later films, where the production code didn't permit moral ambiguity and didn't permit certain kinds of redemption for characters, which is a great crippling effect on Hollywood cinema for a very long time. But this one does have that sophistication and emotional complexity that they had before all of these rules and constraints came in. There were things about suicide that you couldn't do after the production code, and this film does contain a suicide, which is really odd for a film that and ostensibly is kind of a combination of a drama and a comedy. There's some very dark scenes in the film, followed up by some lighter scenes as well. But the interesting thing I found while watching it, and this is my first viewing of the film, is the fact that that change in tone isn't really jarring. They take you from a scene of somebody about to commit suicide and in the act of committing suicide to something much lighter, but it doesn't jar. And that's not an easy thing to pull off in a film. It really does take a lot of care and skill to do. And all credit to George Cukor for doing that as well. But all of the acting, Cukor made this film in 28 days, which is a very short shoot for any kind of film. It was studio bound. There are no external shots. But he was asked about it in a book called Cukor by Gavin Lambert, which is basically Gavin Lambert interviewing George Cukor about his movie career. And Cukor says that the reason it was so easy and so quick to make this film in a mere 28 days was the fact that he had an incredible ensemble of actors, and everybody from the small roles up were incredible professionals and just did the job, did it very well. There weren't a lot of takes necessary, and it was one of the easiest shoots of his career to do because of that. And he said that John Barrymore, who was a very big star at the time, even though he was starting to have the effects of alcohol on him, and less than 10 years later he was dead, really did kind of give his all and didn't seem to have a self-censor. He used his own problems and his own misfortunes to make his role a very memorable one. And there are a couple of scenes where his character is getting the first drink of the day and then slowly gets drunker and drunker as the day progresses. And Barrymore plays that really well. He's kind of running around and well-balanced and articulate and things like that. And there's a gradual slowing and slurring that occurs as his character gets drunker and drunker. As Larry gets drunker and drunker, and that's handled really well. It's a combination of cutting between scenes by Cukor and the skill that Barrymore had, and this is one of those films where you can see why he was made a fuss over at the time and why he was considered an extremely fine actor. And his brother too, we can't forget Lionel Barrymore playing Oliver Jordan, who indeed has his own character arc. His business is failing, even as his health is failing. And that's handled really nicely as well. Those character arcs are pitch perfect by both actors and by the actors around them as well. Particularly, there's a tone shift in the way the ditzy wife, Millicent, played by Billy Burke, handles things when she finds out a certain fact about her husband. And that's handled by her very, very well, and we see the character in a new light as those events occur, which is kind of cool as well. It's not necessarily a redemption, but it's a stripping away of unimportant things. Now, you've got to remember, too, that this film came out in 1933 in the depths of the Depression, and one of the things Cukor in the Gavin Lambert book says is that underneath it all, there's an awareness of the Depression. In this film, people who are wealthy worry about their wealth and how to maintain it. People who aren't wealthy want to become wealthy. People who married into wealth want to retain it as well. And there's a real kind of awareness of that incredible financial insecurity at all levels of society in this film. There's one scene when they're talking about stockbrokers and I'm talking about business advisors, and one of the characters points at the window and says, "Go out there, there are any number of them sitting on those benches outside." And that it really does have a tremendous effect on the way this film is played and makes it very much an artifact of its time. And it also makes you think, how much are our films from 2008 onwards altered by the fact of the global economic crisis? How much will future generations see of that reality in the films we make? You're probably not going to see a lot of it in the Transformers movies, though there is the argument that the breakdown of society is a part of those horrible Transformers movies. But it'd be interesting to see how the future generations view our modern cinema, particularly from Hollywood, in the background of the events, say, between 9/11 and 2008, and all of the changes being wrought by those kind of events. But Dinner at Eight, I recommend it. I really do. And thank you very much, Miss Jane, for recommending it for me and introducing me to the film in that sense. It really does balance drama and comedy as well as any film I've seen. I think that it goes in dark places but doesn't shy from doing that, and also has lighter stuff in there as well, and has a consummately professional cast. The actors in this are awesomely skilled. A lot of them started out on the stage. A lot of them have been doing this for many, many decades. And they bring such experience and talent and humanity to the roles that makes this film an incredibly interesting piece of cinema and one that people should see. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, before I talk about the second movie, I'm going to talk about the interesting and multifarious career of French polymath Boris Vian. Snub.
Je suis snob. C'est vraiment le seul défaut que je gobe. Ça demande des mois d'urbain, c'est une vie de galérien. Mais quand je sors avec Hildegard, c'est toujours moi qu'on regarde. Je suis snob, foutrement snob. Tous mes amis le sont, on est snob et c'est bon. Chemise d'organdi, chaussures de zébu, cravate d'Italie et méchant complet vermoulu. Un rubis au doigt, deux pieds, trois celui-là, les ongles tout noirs et un très joli petit mouchoir. Je vais au cinéma voir des films suédois et j'entre au bistrot pour boire du whisky à gogo. J'ai pas mal au foie, personne fait plus ça. J'ai un nul cerf, c'est moins banal et plus cher. Je suis snob. C'est Bat. Je m'appelle Patrick, mais on dit Bob. Je fais du cheval tous les matins, car j'adore l'odeur du crottin. Je ne fréquente que des baronnes, au nom comme des trombones. Je suis snob, excessivement snob. Et quand je parle d'amour, c'est tout nu dans la cour. Se réunit avec les amis tous les vendredis pour faire des snobismes parties. Il y a du coca, on déteste ça, et du camembert qu'on mange à la petite cuillère. Mon appartement est vraiment charmant, je me chauffe au diamant, on ne peut rien rêver de plus fumant. J'avais la télé, mais ça m'ennuyait, je l'ai retournée. De l'autre côté, c'est passionnant, je suis snob. Ah ah, je suis ravagé par ce microbe. J'ai des accidents en Jaguar. Je passe le mois d'août au Plumard. C'est dans les petits détails comme ça que l'on est snob ou pas. Je suis snob, encore plus snob que tout à l'heure. Et quand je serai mort, je veux un suaire de chez Dior.
That was Boris Vian with Je suis snob. I'm a snob, one of his jazz tracks. He did a lot of things. This guy was a polymath, really, and a very interesting character. Took peyote, did all sorts of weird things. He was a writer, poet, musician, a singer, a translator, a critic, an actor, an inventor, and an engineer. And he wrote crime novels, interestingly enough. He did a crime novel which was called L'Écume des Jours, and another one called I Spit on Your Graves, way before the movie I Spit on Your Grave was created. But there's something very, very special about Boris Vian as far as cinema careers are concerned, and as his place in cinema history. And you've got to give all credit to Boris, because he did some great songs. There was a song called Le Déserteur, The Deserter, which has become a kind of francophone anthem for people who are against wars and who are peace protesters and who are against the draft and conscription and all those sort of things. There's a website where they've translated Lied Zürcher into about 67 languages. So, Boris, a movie was made of one of Boris's novels, I Will Spit on Your Graves. And this is in 1959. So Boris hadn't seen the movie. So he goes to the premiere. And on the morning of the 23rd of June, 1959, he's going to see the movie based on his novel. He went to the Cinema Marbeuf in Paris. And he'd already fought with the producers. I'm reading this from Wikipedia. So he had a big fight with the producers about how they did the movie and wanted to have his name removed from the credits. So a few minutes after the film began, this is reportedly, according to Wikipedia, blurted out, "These guys are supposed to be Americans, my ass." And then he collapsed on his seat and died of a heart attack. So he's the only known author to die of a heart attack as a reaction to a cinematic adaptation of one of his novels. And Boris died basically pissed off with seeing the movie based on his book. So all credit to Boris Vian. He did a lot of different things. He was a liaison for a whole bunch of American jazz musicians who went to Paris. He was a liaison for people like Miles Davis and Duke Ellington. Did a lot of things in his relatively brief life and then died because he was pissed off with a cinematic adaptation of one of his films. He was, at the stage of his death, 39 years old in 1959. So this podcast is dedicated to Boris Vian, and I'm just going to play a little bit of one of his other tracks. This one is called Je Bois, which means I drink.
Je bois systématiquement pour oublier les amis de ma femme. Je bois systématiquement pour oublier tous mes emmerdements. Je bois n'importe quel jaja pourvu qu'il ait ses 12 degrés 5. Je bois la pire des vinasses, c'est dégueulasse, mais ça fait passer le temps.
I'll just translate a few of the lyrics of that one because it's priceless. I drink purposefully to forget my wife's friends. I drink purposefully to forget all my troubles. I drink whatever moonshine as long as it's a minimum of 12%. I drink the worst plonk. It's foul, but it passes the time. Is life such a hoot? Is life such a smash? I ask these two questions. Is life worth living and love when one is a cuckold? I ask these two questions and no one answers. So that's it, basically. Yeah, you got to admire Boris. He had a certain je ne sais quoi and died in a way that is incredibly paleo cinema in some ways. And so here's to you, Boris, and I dedicate this podcast to your memory. Now let's get on with Some Like It Hot.
Not since Scarface, so much action. Not since the Marx Brothers, so much comedy. Not since the 7-year itch, so much Maryland. The best picture this year will also be the funniest.
Good night, sugar.
Good night, honey.
There's one thing sure, boy never met girl like this before. You've never laughed more at sex or a picture about it.
You stay here as long as you like.
Jack may have beaten Tony to the sugar, but not for long.
You're not giving yourself a chance. Don't fight it. Relax.
We'll be right back. the fabulous songs of the Roaring Twenties on the United Artists soundtrack album.
Running wild, lost control, running wild, mighty bold, feeling gay, reckless too, carefree mind all the time, never blue, always going, don't know where, always showing, I don't care, don't love nobody, it's not worthwhile, all alone, running wild.
Okay, Some Like It Hot. I've got a pricey here from IMDb that's not too bad. So for those who came in late, I'll let you know what the movie's about. It's by Gary KMCD. Anyway, when two Chicago musicians, Joe, played by Tony Curtis, and Jerry, played by Jack Lemmon, witnesses St. Valentine's Day Massacre, they want to get out of town and get away from the gangster responsible, Spats Colombo, played by George Raft. They're desperate to get a gig out of town, but the only job they know of is in an all-girl band heading for Florida. They show up at the train station in drag as Josephine and Daphne, the replacement saxophone and bass players. They certainly enjoy being around the girls, especially Sugarcane Kowalczyk, Marilyn Monroe, who sings and plays a ukulele. Joe, in particular, sets out to woo her while Jerry/Daphne is wooed by a millionaire, Osgood Fielding III, played by Joe E. Brown. Mayhem ensues as the two men try to keep their true identities hidden, and as Spats Colombo and his crew show up for a meeting with several other crime lords at the resort they're playing in. So that's it. But to understand this movie, you've got to kind of do a smash cut back in time a little bit to 1920s Germany, and I'll explain why. While I was researching this movie, I was also reading a book called Voluptuous Panic, The Erotic World of Weimar Berlin by Mel Gordon. It's about how in Berlin, after the First World War, when there was hyperinflation and all those kind of economic issues, basically the whole town went sex mad. And at one stage, 25% of the population was in some way involved in the underground sex trade, either as a customer or as a participant to get money. There were all sorts of things. There were bars where you could meet up with, you know, there were places you could meet up with mothers and daughters together. There were kinky dominatrixes, and the kind of boots they wore told you what kind of thing they were into. There were gay bars, lesbian bars, nudist bars, pickup bars, everything you could imagine. Some of which is pretty disgusting. It was available in Weimar Berlin in the 1920s. And in 1926, a young Austrian guy called Billy Wilder moved to Berlin and took up a job as a journalist. Now, he did a few crime stories and a few other things, but he wasn't really successful. Now, here's where fact and fiction kind of blur a little bit. I've heard two stories about this, one of which is that Billy Wilder worked as a taxi dancer in a nightclub for a period of time. This is kind of code word for gigolo. That's one rumor that I've heard. The other rumor, and I'm going on a couple of different research materials, including a biography of Billy Wilder called Nobody's Perfect, Billy Wilder, A Personal Biography by Charlotte Chandler. In that one, Billy Wilder says he kind of pretended to be a taxi dancer for a short time to get a story for a newspaper he was working for or a magazine he was working for. It's a little bit, you know, iffy there, but one way or the other, Billy Wilder was in some way involved in the decadent underworld of Weimar Berlin in 1926 to 1933 when he went to America. So, the kind of thing you see in Some Like It Hot is very familiar territory for him. The cross-dressing, the pretending to be a woman, the polymorphous perversity of it all. He even got a drag queen that he knew from Weimar Berlin called Barbette to come over to America and teach Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon how to be drag queens. And indeed, Barbette did so, and then left really in a hurry because she didn't like the way, didn't think that they could do the job, the two actors. So went off to back to Europe. So, but Tony Curtis's biography is very interesting on this one too. He says that when they got into the makeup and the costume to be dressed up as women, he decided that he and Jack Lemmon were going to test it by going into the ladies' bathroom at the commissary at the studio they were working at the time. And nobody noticed them. They just thought they were women. But Tony Curtis wasn't happy with the makeup, so he got the makeup people to do the makeup again and to make particularly Jack Lemmon look a little more attractive in some ways. They went back into the toilets, and a woman walked into the toilets and said, "Hi, Tony." And then Tony Curtis just walked out with Jack Lemmon. But anyway, the drag thing is a very interesting aspect of this film, and it's treated with a certain amount of European maturity as well. There are some twists and turns in this, and I'll talk about Marilyn Monroe in a bit, but this drag thing is quite sophisticated for 1959 in America. Yes, it's treated for laughs, and yes, it's humorous, and the guys trying to walk on high heels is a bit funny, and the bra slipping and all sorts of things like that, and the proximity they have to the other girl band members, particularly Sugar, played by Marilyn Monroe, has a certain humour about it. And, yeah, you can kind of see the guys feeling quite uncomfortable at times about being there, but and yet fascinated as well by this world that men never usually see. Now, Billy Wilder's sense of humour at the best of times was quite dark, so there are a few bits of business in this movie that are quite dark and interesting, particularly around the gangsters and the way the gangsters treat each other and the what happens to Spats Columbo. His comeuppance is quite interesting as well. But in general, this movie is remembered for the humour and for two, you know, quite prominent actors, one of whom was starting a career as a serious character actor, being Tony Curtis at the time, and Jack Lemmon had been known for a number of comedies like Mr. Roberts and things like that, and was starting his career. This is about a decade or more before he started to do serious work like Save the Tiger and the Sunshine Boys and all those sort of things, and he got his recognition as a serious character actor as well. At the time, Tony Curtis was doing things like The Defiant Ones and movies like that, which were serious acting roles, and Sweet Smell of Success. So he was getting a reputation as being, started out doing sword and Arabian Nights kind of movies, and The Black Shield of Falworth, playing swashbuckling roles and things like that. But he obviously wanted to do more with his career than that. And right up until the late 70s, when he started to have a little bit too much of a fondness for cocaine, he did follow that path, and the cocaine really did put a kibosh on his career. He died a couple of years ago, but his career was long, and there are things like the Boston Strangler, for instance, his role in The Defiant One, Sweet Smell of Success, Lepke, amongst other things, where he's chops as a dramatic actor, in no doubt at all. And in this movie, he does bring some really good acting chops as well. If you see him in drag playing Josephine, he is channeling people like Eve Arden and other strong female actors of the decade just before this, so like the 1940s and 1950s, strong, upright female characters, and he does it very, very well. Whereas Jack Lemmon's character, Daphne, is kind of, he plays it ditzy and plays it a little bit broad, and I think that his character has the most interesting arc as well, because Daphne starts enjoying being a woman, particularly when Osgood starts wooing her. And Joey Brown, who was a comedian from movies in the 1930s, he did a number of weird and wonderful comedies. He was a contemporary of people like Eddie Cantor and all those kind of comedians at the time. He had this as a great role, and he goes all out too. I mean, here he is playing up to a man in drag as if he's a woman, and doing a very good job of it too. I mean, Joey Brown was married for his whole movie career to the one woman and all that kind of thing. But these guys did take a chance with their careers in playing these kind of roles. I mean, Joey Brown didn't do too much afterwards because he was an older actor. But Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis were taking risks. I mean, you've got to remember that 6 years after this, Victim came out, and for playing a homosexual character, Dirk Bogarde's career as a leading man was pretty much killed by doing that. And playing somebody in drag was a definite risk for these actors, but they wanted to go ahead and do it. And Tony Curtis said it was a very interesting experience and that he and Jack Lemmon had a lot of fun doing the role and working with Billy Wilder as well, one of the great dramatic and comedy directors of the 40s and 50s and into the 1960s as well, was something that both of them really enjoyed the opportunity for. And Wilder himself had nothing bad to say about either of them. But the problem in the movie, though, was Marilyn Monroe. She was in an unfortunate phase of her life. She was married to Arthur Miller at the time and had just had a miscarriage. And her and Arthur Miller were trying to have another child. And obviously, even a woman who's a lot more mentally stable than Marilyn Monroe would have a problem after a miscarriage carrying the female end of a major motion picture for a studio. But, yeah, she was late on set. She didn't turn up some days. They had to do dozens of takes and some things until they got one where Marilyn was good in it. And when Tony Curtis said that famous quote about kissing her was like kissing Hitler, it was very much a reaction to the fact that they had to do so many multiple takes. These guys were waiting around. They did 20 or 30 takes for one scene with her. And most of the time they were dressed in drag, so the clothing they were wearing was very uncomfortable for them. And they found that a little bit of an issue. But Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe had had a bit of a fling in the early 1950s as well, and he spoke kindly and fondly of her in later years once he understood the problems she had and the abuse issues and the mental health issues and all those sorts of things. He kind of turned that around and spoke more kindly of her in retrospect than he did at the time the movie was being made, or even just somewhat after that. But yeah, Marilyn Monroe, I'm not as fond of her as a lot of guys are. I can appreciate that she had a certain kind of brassy sexiness about her, but she's not the kind of actor that turns me on, if you know what I mean, intellectually or physically as well. She's always seemed a little artificial, and in a way that what isn't kind of attractive to me. But everybody's got different tastes. For me, people like Ava Gardner are a lot more sexy than her because they had a confidence about themselves, whereas Marilyn Monroe's persona and possibly her real self had a vulnerability and a little girlness about it, even though she did have a certain kind of sexiness about her. I'm not describing that well, but we're getting into deep and dark territory here. It's a little hard to say it with any accuracy. But yeah, Marilyn Monroe, I think this is not one of her best roles. I think that the things she did, like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, were a lot better. Bus Stop was a lot better. River of No Return was pretty good. There were, and of course, The Misfits in 1961, which she did with Clark Gable, was very good. But this is definitely one of them because she wasn't in a fit state to make a movie, to be really honest about it. But yeah, the movie, getting back to the sexuality of the drag things, the fact that Daphne, the character played by Jack Lemmon, likes being a woman and decides that he likes being engaged to Osgood, and which of course leads to the best punchline at the end of any movie in movie history, which is, and I'm not going to give away the full punchline, but I'm going to give away a little bit of it, which is this.
Well, nobody's perfect.
It's a lot of fun, and there are lots of little bits of business that are really good fun, like when George Raft sees a gangster flipping a coin and tells him to stop doing that, it's stupid or something like that. The guy he's saying that to is actually Edward G. Robinson Jr., but that was something that Raft himself had done in a lot of movies, so there are a lot of little bits of business like that. Originally, Wilder wanted Edward G. Robinson to play the role that Nemiah Persoff played in the movie as the kind of big Al Capone type character. But he didn't know at the time when he was trying to get Robinson that Robinson and Raft hated each other's guts and that Robinson had promised never to work in a movie with George Raft ever again. Which is, and they got Edward G. Robinson Jr. a role in there thinking it would kind of entice Edward G. Robinson Sr. to work in the movie, but it didn't. And so that's why Edward G. Robinson Jr. is in there, and then Maya Persoff is playing the Al Capone type role. And anyway, Edward G. Robinson got his chance to play that sort of role in later years when he did Robin and the Seven Hoods with Sinatra and the Rat Pack. There's a scene very similar to the scene that's in Some Like It Hot, which Robinson gets to play and plays extremely well on it. But I keep coming back to the sexual politics of this movie and the fact that Jack Lemmon gets engaged to Joe E. Brown's character. I think that the sophistication of Billy Wilder's time in Weimar Berlin and the fact that there were everybody was out about who they were. There were gay people and straight people and lesbians and all sorts of... The underworld was very much visible and not criticised. I mean, the cops didn't raid these places very much at all because so much of the economy depended on people coming from overseas and bringing money into Berlin via these clubs where you could... everybody was using marks at the time and inflation marks and things like that, but people were coming in from France and Italy and England and even America to enjoy the sexual freedom that was in Berlin at the time. And with them, they brought a lot of money that wasn't suffering hyperinflation the way that the German mark was, where people would get paid in the morning and spend the money at lunchtime because it wouldn't be worth anything by the time they finished work in the afternoon. And all of those crazy things that happened with the hyperinflation in Germany at the time. And a lot of it's a direct relation to that. And the darker aspects of Nazism started in those clubs around Berlin and places like that too. There are a lot of darkly perverse things that the Nazis did that really did come from that area at that particular time. But just to wrap up Some Like It Hot, yeah, it's great comedy. It's ahead of its time as far as the sexual politics is concerned. Some people like it for Marilyn Monroe. I like it for the Jack Lemmon character and the Tony Curtis character. And the Tony Curtis character, there's that very morally dubious bit where he also plays a millionaire putting on a Cary Grant accent so as to seduce Sugar, and pretends to be impotent. And they're on the yacht, which he's borrowed without Osgood's knowledge from Osgood. And he kind of implies that he has never been able to get it up with a woman. And because Sugar is basically a gold digger, she sees that as a challenge. Now, the fine line there is she's lying too because she basically wants to marry a millionaire regardless. He's lying about being impotent and about being a millionaire. And so both of them are lying to each other. And yet sparks fly and they indeed get it on. So, I mean, that's morally dubious. I mean, is he taking advantage of her? Is she taking advantage of him? That complexity and that kind of moral ambiguity is something that Wilder put in a lot of movies. And I think a lot of it relates back to that experience in 1920s Germany. So I'm going to wrap it up there and say that you should see Some Like It Hot if you haven't seen it for a while. It is a lot of fun. And to thank Miss Jane for suggesting it as her payback for being a patron of Paleo Cinema Podcast. Now, there wasn't any feedback this time around, which is a bit disappointing, and you guys have all let me down. But I do have to go through the credits because we do have credits at the end of the podcast now for the people who were supporters of the podcast and continue to be. So we've got Alyssa, who's our location scout. We've got Tansy, who is our Foley artist. We have Miss Jane, who's the wardrobe mistress. We've got Christopher M., who's the gaffer. Chris M., who's the camera operator. Julia, who I saw last night at the club, is our casting director. Jan is our dialect coach. Gary is a property master, and Morris is our musical director. So that's about it for this time around on Paleo Cinema Podcast. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another one, and I'll be back in a week with another Martian Drive-In podcast. So in the meantime, enjoy your films, get into drag if that's your sort of thing, pick up Marilyn Monroe's Hip Flask if you want to, but anyway, take care of yourselves, and I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with yet more old movies.